Afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme, and we're here every Saturday at 12 noon to promote and to defend public education. And we believe that never has the time been more important than our mission at the present time. We've got a fairly full programme for you. The teachers are restive, as they should be. But so are the parents, and so are, by the way, quite a few taxpayers about where the money's going in education. It doesn't take very much observation to see that it's all going to the private sector. And the question is, why? Why? Now, we all know that more and more our so-called democracies are becoming oligarchies, in a who knows who world. But we did a little bit of scratching around about ministers of education, and we came up with press release 1062. And here is Ambie to tell you about it.
Thanks, Jane. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1062. Why do Labor governments continue to shortchange public education in favour of the private sector? There is no question that public schools have received a raw deal under both Labor and Coalition governments. Little is expected of Coalition governments, but the track record of the Labor Party is dismal indeed. Why? The latest Productivity Commission's report on government services again exposes a deeply unfair school funding system, with government funding growth continuing to favour private schools over public schools, despite rising student need. The report shows that private schools are now publicly subsidised to a greater extent than ever before. In 2013-14, private schools received 67.7% of the combined government funding per student. In 2023-24, this has increased to 70.8%. Private schools have received significantly stronger growth in real government funding than public schools over the past decade, both in total funding and on a per student basis. Combined Commonwealth and state government funding to private schools has grown 30.6% faster than funding to public schools over the last 10 years. This is yet another year where the data shows that private schools continue to receive the lion's share of government funding growth while public schools are being shortchanged, said AEU Federal President Corina Haythorpe. Despite educating the vast majority of students with the highest needs, public schools are falling further behind because governments continue to prioritise funding growth for private schools. Alarmingly, the report also shows that per-student government funding for public schools went backwards in the last year, driven by a decline in primary school funding. Funding per primary student fell from $18,942 in 2022-23 to $18,853 in 2023-24, while overall recurrent funding per public school student declined for the first time in a decade. The Dogs have a simple answer. Research into the schooling and commitment of Victorian Labor Ministers of Education, Ben Carroll and James Merlino, in part explains their commitment to the private sector. But the immediate post-political careers of James Merlino and his federal counterpart, Jacinta Collins, leave the public school supporter in no doubt whatsoever. Ben Carroll, the current Victorian Minister for Education and Deputy Premier since 2023, is Ben. He attended St Christopher's Primary School and St Bernard's College, Essendon, before studying law at La Trobe University. Given the example of his Labor predecessors at the state and federal level, and the current sterling work he is doing on behalf of his alma mater, it will be interesting to follow the post-political career of Ben Carroll. James Merlino. Ben Carroll's Victorian Labor Party predecessor in the Minister for Education portfolio was James Merlino. According to Wikipedia, Merlino attended St Edmunds Primary School in Melbourne, where he became interested in politics. With the election of Andrews' Labor government in late 2014, Merlino became Deputy Premier and Education Minister. Merlino was a member of Labor's right faction and is a Catholic. So it was not a surprise that when he retired from politics, he stepped straight into the chairmanship of a newly established Catholic Education Commission of Victoria. The following report appeared on the website of the Victorian Catholic Education Authority. 6th of December 2023, James Molino appointed as Chair of Victorian Catholic Education Authority. The Victorian Catholic Education Authority, VCEA, the renewed peak body for Catholic education in Victoria, has appointed James Molino as its inaugural chair. The VCEA was previously the Catholic Education Commission of Victoria, CECV. In 2021, the bishop members of CECV commissioned an independent review into its role, governance and operations. An extensive renewal process followed, which culminated in an annual general meeting yesterday, when the Archbishop of Melbourne and the bishops of Ballarat, Sale and Sandhurst accepted VCEA's new constitution, company name, and the appointment of Mr. James Merlino, Ms. Lynn Glover and Mr. Damien Murphy as company directors, with Mr. Merlino appointed as chair. The AGM was an important milestone in establishing the Victorian Catholic Education Authority as the peak body for Catholic education in the state, and it is a privilege to be appointed as the inaugural chair, Mr. Molino said. I'd like to thank our CEO, Jim Miles, for his work to date, and I look forward to working with the VCEA team. The VCEA will build on the excellent work of the CECV and, in partnership with Catholic school proprietors, help Catholic schools continue to flourish and provide an outstanding service to the Victorian community. Under the leadership of the new board, the VCEA will build on a successful renewal process and move into the next phase, providing exceptional support and leadership to school proprietors, students, parents, teachers and staff across all Victorian Catholic school communities, Mr. Miles said. Mr. Molino served as Deputy Premier of Victoria and Minister for Education from December 2014 until June 2022 in the first and second Andrews Ministry. He has deep knowledge of the education sector and Victoria, as well as a deep connection to his Catholic faith. Ms. Glover has served as a senior executive within the Victorian Public Service across various government departments and agencies with more than 40 years of experience, including as CEO of the Victorian Registration and Qualifications Authority. VCEA serves as the peak body for Catholic education in Australia. It represents and advocates on behalf of Catholic education in Victoria on state and national matters, acts as the approved authority for Catholic schools in Victoria, reviews and assures compliance of Catholic education with school registration requirements, and undertakes a range of other activities to support Catholic education in Victoria. So much for separation of church and state in Victoria and the welfare of the public education system. However, if the close connection between politicians, private religious schools and education funding in Victoria has become an open joke in the Victorian Labor Party, the federal connection between church and state has been even more deleterious for public education. Consider the career of Jacinta Collins, a prominent Victorian Labor senator and minister from 1995 to 2019. According to Wikipedia, Jacinta Mary Ann Collins, born 4th of September 1962, is a former Australian politician who served as a senator for Victoria from 1995 to 2005 and again from 2008 to 2019. She represented the Australian Labor Party and was the party's deputy leader in the Senate from June to October 2013. Collins was promoted to the second Gillard Ministry as the Parliamentary Secretary for School Education and Workplace Relations on the 14th of September 2010. A Parliamentary Secretary in the Gillard Government and Minister for Mental Health and Ageing in the second Rudd Government. She resigned from the Senate on the 15th of February 2019 and was announced as the new head of the National Catholic Education Commission on the same day. She commenced her role on the 18th of February 2019. So the Labor politician responsible in 2010 for the initial implementation of the Gonski Report in 2010 accepted an appointment as a National Executive Director of the National Catholic Education Commission on the 18th of February 2019. Not surprisingly, on the 4th of May 2023, Jacinta Collins, a passionate education advocate who champions the needs of Catholic schools, teachers and students, was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Conclusion. Dogs rest their case. Separation between church and state in Australia is well and truly broken. The corruption and jobs for the boys mentality that follows has become normalised to the great detriment of our public education system, our egalitarian society, our democracy, our social cohesion and parliamentary accountability for proper expenditure of taxpayer funds. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? And in The Age on Friday, February the 13th, on page 2, there was a very interesting article about James Molino in his job, his current job, Now, this Mr. Molino, as you might have recalled, started off in the union movement and went there from his career in the Labour Party, although he obviously had the right contacts in the private school sector because he got a nice job after he left politics. And what's he doing now? James Molino, former number two in Dan Andrews' state Labor government, has come a long way since his days as a stalwart comrade in the shoppies union. The former brickie, it's true, they checked, now chairs the board of the Victorian Catholic Education Authority, an outfit with a reputation for taking a tough line with its workplace unions. Now, the Molino-led authority's latest spat with the Independent Education Union, representing most of the state's Catholic school teachers and support staff, is turning nasty. So the union said that it won a ballot of 33 of the separate church-related education entities, which bargain under the VCAA umbrella, claiming a majority of the staff voted, which numbered up to 35,000, were in favour of being treated as a single workplace as they wrangle for a new pay deal. But the authority reckons the correct number of workers at its associated entities is 45,000, and that the union hasn't won a majority at all. So there's this spat going on. And word out of the authority's East Melbourne headquarters is that it's possible that some confusion has crept into the process, given that there are tens of thousands of employment records from each Catholic school employer, and some casual relief teachers might work at multiple different schools at different times. So the poor Catholic teachers are having trouble with Mr. Molino and the Catholic authorities with their facts and their figures about how many of them actually exist. So there you are, there's a little bit of scuttlebutt for you, thanks to the Age. But now let's find out a little bit more about the financial position. 38 billion schooling for, there's a 38 billion infrastructure gap for public schools. Let's hear about it.
Thank you, Jean. This is a press release from the Australian Education Union. $38 billion school infrastructure gap as public schools left behind. A new report reveals a deep and growing divide in school infrastructure funding, with private schools spending billions on capital infrastructure while public schools are left behind, with no ongoing Commonwealth capital funding since 2017. A research paper titled The Building Divide in Australian Schools: How Capital Funding Fuels Educational Inequity reveals that over the past decade, private schools have outspent public schools on capital works by $38 billion, including $5.4 billion in 2023 alone. It shows that capital investment in private schools averaged $2,746 per student per year between 2014 and 2023, compared with just $1,237 per student in public schools. This inequity is fueled by the lack of federal funding for capital investment in public schools. AEU Federal President Karenna Haythorpe said this imbalance dates back to 2017, when the Turnbull government ceased the Commonwealth's long-term capital funding stream for public schools. Between 2017 and 2025, the Commonwealth's non-government school capital grants program has delivered more than $1.6 billion to private schools, with a further almost $3 billion scheduled between 2025 and 2034. By contrast, public schools receive no permanent federal capital stream. In 2023 alone, the highest spending private schools collectively outlaid sums that exceeded the total capital expenditure of thousands of public schools combined. In some cases, single private schools spent more on building projects than entire public school systems in smaller states and territories. AEU Federal President Karenna Haythorpe said the divide is being driven by Commonwealth policy settings that fund capital works in private schools while leaving public schools without a long-term federal stream. Elite private schools are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on castle-style libraries, Olympic-sized swimming pools, rooftop sports courts, and multi-story innovation centres, while the Commonwealth has provided no ongoing capital funding stream for public schools since 2017, Ms. Haythorpe said. Too often, temporary solutions like demountable classrooms have become permanent solutions. Teachers can't effectively prepare students for the future in classrooms and facilities built for the past. Public schools educate the majority of children and deserve high-quality, state-of-the-art teaching and learning facilities. This inequity has to stop. When five private schools are spending more than 50% of Australia's public schools altogether, it is clear the system is working for the wealthy and against everyone else. That is not an accident. It is the result of policy choices that keep directing public funding towards already wealthy private schools. The AEU is calling on the Commonwealth to 1. Provide a significant and immediate injection of capital investment to public schools in recognition of and partial rectification of the billions of dollars lost through the abandonment of Commonwealth capital funding in 2017. 2. Create a permanent Commonwealth capital fund to ensure that all public schools have access to the funds they need to provide adequate and safe 21st century learning environments. 3. Negotiate a joint partnership with state and territory governments to invest in new and upgraded public schools and facilities with the provision that Commonwealth capital funding for public schools triggers increased investments from state and territory governments. 4. Ensure that all public schools have access to funds prioritising purpose-built learning spaces and school facilities, including modified bathrooms and playgrounds that are accessible for all students with disability. 5. Work with and incentivise state and territory governments to ensure all growth suburbs have public, primary and secondary schools that are open and accessible when residents arrive. And 6, ensure that the capital works required to implement the Thriving Kids Initiative in public schools are funded through the initiative, not through recurrent or capital schools funding. We know that great facilities deliver great results for students and for teachers, Ms. Haythorpe said. If the federal government wants schools to do more, including supporting students with complex needs, they must invest in the buildings and spaces that make that possible. A guaranteed, long-term, federally funded capital works package will provide much-needed improvements to public schools and ensure schools are fit for the future. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much to Andy and Dale for that, but I think the time has come for a break.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR, Radical Radio.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program, because there's the question of Trevor Kobold writing again. And although we have an election here in Victoria later in the year, there's one in a few weeks over in South Australia. So Trevor Kobold has written about school outcomes and funding in that state for this election. Over to Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. School Outcomes and Funding in South Australia, an election brief. And this is an article written by Trevor Cobbold and published on the 15th of February. The South Australian election will be held on the 24th of March. The following are key points of a brief on the South Australian election campaign by Save Our Schools. The full brief can be downloaded from the Save Our Schools website. South Australian public schools, like all public schools throughout Australia, face deep inequity and chronic underfunding, especially for socioeconomically disadvantaged students. Candidates in the South Australian election must stand up for public schools. Inequity in school outcomes. Half to two-thirds of socioeconomically disadvantaged South Australian Year 9 students fail to meet national literacy and numeracy standards. Achievement gaps between advantaged and socioeconomically disadvantaged students grow throughout schooling years and equal 4 to 5 years of learning by Year 9. A substantial proportion of socioeconomically disadvantaged students do not complete Year 12. Socioeconomically disadvantaged students are concentrated in public schools, and over 90% of socioeconomically disadvantaged schools are public schools. Public schools are vastly underfunded. Public schools have far fewer resources per student than Catholic and independent schools, despite the learning challenges they face. Government funding increases since 2009 have favoured private schools by more than double. Despite a new funding agreement, public schools will still not be fully funded by 2034, and the large part of the increase is delayed until after 2029. Cumulative public school underfunding is estimated at $3.1 billion over 10 years, from 2025 to 2034. Funding shortfalls are driven by delayed Commonwealth and state funding increases and accounting tricks. The new funding agreement between the Commonwealth and the state government discriminates against public schools. Increasing equity in education is an election priority. South Australia's new strategy for public education shows gains in student enrolments and achievements in public schools. It is important to continue investments in equity, teacher professionalism, student agency, and wellbeing to sustain these positive trends. The fundamental education challenge for candidates in the South Australian election is to increase equity in education. This means increasing the proportion of students who complete Year 12 or its equivalent and reducing the achievement gaps between rich and poor. Election candidates must commit to full funding of public schools by 2029, including removal of all accounting tricks that defraud public schools. Full funding of public schools will enhance the effectiveness of the state's public education policy strategy. The increased funding for public schools should provide more teachers, support staff, and wraparound services. It could support policies such as full-service schools, family engagement, school meals, and removal of compulsory fees to improve equity. Four questions for election parties and candidates. In the election campaign, candidates and parties must clearly answer four basic questions. 1. Do you support full funding of South Australian public schools by 2029? 2. Do you support a revision of the funding agreement between the Commonwealth and South Australian governments to require the South Australian government to increase its funding share of public schools to 75% of their SRS by 2029? 3. Do you support removing all special allowances in the current Commonwealth-South Australian bilateral funding agreement that allow the South Australian government to defraud public schools by including non-school expenditures as part of its share of the SRS? And 4. Do you support the new strategy for public education that shows early positive gains in education outcomes by giving priority to inclusion, well-being, and increased equity in school outcomes? And those are excellent questions indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andy. And now we're back to Dale again, and she's going to tell us about the TAFE workforce in Victoria and its problems. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is a press release from the AEU from the 18th of February 2026. TAFE workforce stretched to breaking point. The TAFE teaching workforce and its facilities are under extreme pressure with complexity of students, increased enrolments, and ageing facilities impacting on teaching and learning. The AEU has released its 2026 State of Our TAFE report, which shows that despite a recent injection in funding, the sector is still crying out for help Using responses from 1,696 TAFE teachers across the country, the report shows widespread workload intensification, staff shortages, and declining retention, even as enrollments surge under a reinvigorated TAFE system. Nearly two-thirds of respondents said they had considered leaving their job in the past year, and almost half do not expect to still be working in TAFE within 5 years. AEU Federal President Corinna Haythorpe said the findings are a warning that despite recent investment in TAFE under the Albanese government, urgent action to support TAFE teachers and campuses is still needed. Decades of underfunding have stretched TAFE teachers to breaking points, and these survey results are a wake-up call for governments, Ms. Haythorpe said. Free TAFE has been transformative for students and communities, but its implementation has presented some additional challenges for TAFE teachers. Teachers also reported significant increases in students presenting with mental health, literacy, numeracy, and digital skills needs, without additional learning or support services to meet that demand. Students enrolling in free TAFE have significantly higher levels of additional needs than the TAFE student cohort overall, and TAFE teachers have reported on the fact that TAFE institutes are generally not resourced well enough to cater for their needs, Ms. Haythorpe said. Free TAFE has opened the door to education for people who were previously locked out, but governments have failed to fund the wraparound supports students need to succeed, Ms. Haythorpe said. Teachers are increasingly expected to fill the gaps by providing pastoral care, wellbeing support, and foundation skills without the time, training, or resources to do so. The report, released to coincide with the National TAFE Council Executive Meeting, shows 88% of teachers knew a colleague who had left TAFE in the past 12 months, while more than half reported reduced student contact hours despite rising administrative and compliance demands. TAFE teachers are committed to their students, but excessive workloads, insecure and casualised employment, and uncompetitive pay are pushing skilled teachers out of the sector at the very moment Australia needs them most. Almost two-thirds of TAFE staff surveyed have considered leaving their jobs in the past year, and nearly half do not expect to be working in TAFE in 5 years' time. Without a teaching workforce, TAFE cannot succeed. The report also highlights chronic underinvestment in TAFE infrastructure, with outdated equipment and overcrowded campuses impacting on the system's ability to meet local skills needs. Rebuilding TAFE means more than funding courses, Ms. Haythorpe said. It requires serious, long-term investment in secure jobs for teachers, manageable workloads, modern campuses, and properly funded student support services. The AEU is calling on Commonwealth, state and territory governments to urgently commit to a national TAFE workforce renewal and retention strategy, a significant capital works and equipment program, and guaranteed funding for ongoing student support. TAFE is a public institution and a public good, Ms. Haythorpe said. Indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that's very interesting, but our time has come to go overseas with Jeff. And here he is taking us over to the UK this week.
Good afternoon. This week we're going to be exploring two articles from the UK, one involving a crackdown on private school fees from the English government, British government, and the other one which is exploring phone-free schools. And both of them are interesting, I think. Firstly, the crackdown on special school fees. Let's see. This is in Schools Week, which is an online blog, from Tuesday, 24th of Feb. And this one's written by Freddie Whittaker and Samantha Booth. And it is entitled, from the 24th of February, Private Special School Fees Capped in Profit Before Children Crackdown. And it begins, plan for price bans and national standards follows award-winning exposure by Schools Week of soaring private sector spend. Ministers will for the first time cap the fees independent special schools can charge councils for provision, with the Education Secretary vowing to crack down on providers who put profit before children. The institutions will be subject to new national price bans, which will end unjustified fee variation for the same provision, giving councils the confidence to challenge poor value placements. And new statutory special education needs and disability specific standards will ensure every independent special school delivers consistent high quality support and clear outcomes for pupils. It comes after reports suggested the government planned to set up an upper limit of £60,000 on fees. This has not been officially announced, nor have the price bans been set out. The school's white paper, due to be published next week, will also ensure full cost transparency and will show exactly how public money is spent. That clarity would be welcome in Australia, that's my aside. And ministers will give councils a formal say on new or expanding independent provisions so places are created where children actually need them. Soaring spending is exposed. Schools Week has revealed the soaring spend by councils on independent special schools amid the state capacity crisis in recent years. Our awards-winning investigation unveiled the big companies involved making millions, including those backed by private equity investors and a Middle East sovereign wealth fund. Several of these firms also run children's homes. Ministers announced a profit cap on the children's social care sector last year. Recent Department for Education analysis found of the 15 private equity funds that own independent special schools, 5 are based outside of the United Kingdom. This includes Jersey, Guernsey, USA, Qatar and Abu Dhabi. Collectively, these own 170 schools, 19%, with 9,000 pupils. In 2024-25, councils spent £2.1 billion on independent special school and non-maintained special school places. The latter are usually run by not-for-profit charitable organisations. This is the first time it's gone over the £2 billion mark. It has risen 88% from £1.1 billion in 2021. The Department for Education said these schools charge an average of £63,000 per child per year, which is more than twice the £26,000 cost of a state special school. Fees vary, but some independent special schools charge more than £100,000 a year. Phillipson decries profit before children is the headline, sub-headline. The government said more than 30% of schools were backed by private equity firms with public money intended for children and young people with the most complex needs instead flowing into private profit. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson said for too long families have faced a postcard lottery, fighting for support that depends on where they live, not what their child needs. That ends now. We're cracking down on providers who put profit before children. New standards and proper oversight will ensure every independent special school placement delivers real outcomes for children, not unreasonable bills for local authorities. This is about building a system where every child with special education needs and disabilities can achieve and thrive at a school that's right for them and delivers the life chances they deserve. The proposals have been welcomed by Louise Gittins, who chairs the Local Government Association. While in some cases an independent school can be the best place for a child to attend, it's wrong that when some councils' own costs are soaring, that some providers are setting unreasonably high prices and making significant profits from state-funded placements, she said. Don't be scapegoat schools. But Claire Dora, chief executive of the National Association of Special Schools, which represents state and private schools, said these settings currently fill the gaps where local capacity simply does not exist. Scapegoating these schools as driving costs does a disservice to special schools and the crucial role they have played in shoring up a dysfunctional special education needs and disability system. She added, debates that focus solely on the costs ignore the true value of specialist provision and rarely make valid like-for-like comparisons of provision. Independent special schools support children who require the most complex multidisciplinary support. So, yeah, that's the end. I'll leave the article there. It goes on a bit longer. But I highly recommend having a look at it. They're cracking down on exploitative, investment companies who are using this to make profits off children's needs and ballooning costs for the public purse. Now, I'm going to go to a really interesting article I found in Relocate, which is an international education blog, a Relocate magazine it's called. It's aimed at leaders and decision makers across the globe. And it's about a general article on exploring phone-free schools. And it asks, this is written by Ledetta Avsa-Wasson, who's an education correspondent. It's from the 19th of February, 26. And it says, exploring phone-free schools. What's the difference between phone bans versus phone-free schools? Does it have a positive impact on learning and behaviour? And how do students stand to benefit? Phone bans and phone-free schools were a hot topic, both on and off stage at this year's BETT show, a conference that spotlights innovations in education and technology. In January, the UK's Department of Education updated its non-statutory guidance that all schools should be phone-free environments by default. Soon after, the House of Lords backed a ban on students using phones during the school day and debates for and against continue. A survey of UK schools shows that 99.8% of primary schools and 90% of secondary schools have some form of limit or restriction on phones in place. However, the real challenge is turning policy into meaningful change for teachers, students, parents and the wider school community. An insightful panel focuses on outcomes discussed and what happens when schools go beyond policy to implement well-structured phone-free programs and explore the benefits, complexities and community effort required for them to succeed. A phone ban versus a phone-free. Addressing a packed arena, the panel elaborated on phone ban versus phone-free, and if there is a difference. There is a difference. You see, many countries that just implement a phone ban, which means nothing more sophisticated. It's about a child not letting their phone be seen so that it's in their bag. The danger is that it puts a lot of pressure on the child to not resist that addiction. The other thing that it creates is conflict. In Greece, for example, the rule is that you suspend a child if their phone is seen, explained former Minister of State for Education, Sinek Gibb. What I've seen in some parts of the world, like New York and Texas, for example, is an approach where they say the school environment from bell to bell should be phone-free. They're either collecting them and giving them back in the school day or putting them in a lockable pouch so they cannot be accessed. It needs to be something more sophisticated than a simple phone ban that leads to this conflict. Emma Mills, Director of Education at One Community Trust, a group of 8 schools, has experience of implementing a phone-free environment, having tried different methods. We used an out-of-sight policy for years and years, and we have a huge problem with phones in schools. It wasn't that things were happening in the classroom and phones were out all the time. We were just very aware that pupils were still thinking about their phones, taking them in toilets at lunchtime or hiding them around a corner to have a sneaky peek. It was also that their attention wasn't just 100% in the classroom. However, Mills suggested the flaws was in the policy, not the pupils. If someone said to me, put your phone in your pocket all day, but no matter what sounds it makes, you're not allowed to look at it, I couldn't do it. These are children with a really addictive device, and they deserve to be free from that. They deserve to be able to enjoy their childhood. They deserve to be able to fully engage in their education. So it was really important to us that we went phone-free. Gibbs spoke on the need for the policy to be better thought through so there was no pressure or punishment placed on the child. He added it was an issue of equity too, needing to protect those who may be more vulnerable to addiction and to allow all students to flourish. While he welcomed the DfE's updated phone-free guidance, he expressed the need to go further and legislate in a more structured and intentional way that supports head teachers to enforce it and help with any resistance from parents. Nurturing a phone-free culture. According to Mills, their chosen approach for creating a phone-free school environment has been to keep it as simple as possible. Students get a Yonder pouch that they keep for 5 years and they take home with them. When they come in each morning, they meet staff at the gate and put their phone in the pouch, which clicks shut and is kept with them. When the school day finishes, pupils simply unclip their phone on an unlocking base and they've got it back to use on the way home. It's really simple and easy structure. The biggest part is that the build-up to doing it and really making children understand why we're doing it. You want to create a culture that helps them understand the benefits of it and not just see it as something that's been done to them, added Mills. She knows the benefits of going phone-free well and shared some evidence and reflections of the school's journey so far, from freeing up teachers to reducing student stress. It has improved every single aspect of school. When we went phone-free, I was doing it from a sort of moral point of view to help children see they could live without phones and for them to be fully immersed in school. I did not anticipate the levels of improvements that we made. Reeling off a number of positive anecdotes, Mill describes that in 1 year, the school group managed to reduce safeguarding incidents around mobile phones and social media by 81%, going from 246 incidents down to 48 incidents. We saw 94% reduction in our behaviour incidents that were connected to phones as well, and that was directly connected to going phone-free. Mills shared examples of the beneficial impact of learning and performance too, not just on relationships and well-being. Our exam results went up too. English and maths in 1 year went up by 17%, and our attainment 8 went up too, especially for disadvantaged pupils. At breaks and lunch, things are so much easier. Children are talking, playing, and interacting with each other. 100% of students in a school of 1,000 go to enrichment clubs on a Monday and Tuesday lunchtime. It's so much more than putting a phone in a pouch. It's the culture that it creates. Graham Degani, a phone-free advocate and founder and CEO of Yonder, eludes that there's even more to be gained from students disconnecting at school. We've been helping schools become phone-free for 12 years, and the zeitgeist around the subject globally has changed immensely during that time. Every person, young and old, is wrestling with this question around the role of technology in their lives. Degani highlighted the importance of constructive and positive language when instilling a phone-free culture in schools that doesn't chide young people or treat it as punishment. It's not a punitive thing. We're not taking something away from students. We're giving them something back, he added. I see phone-free schools as a foundational building block for all other things you want to see happen in a school, from academic performance to reduction in disciplinary issues. But it's about this kind of hidden curriculum too, things like body language, eye contact, the ability to think critically and not be tempted to use the internet for everything every 2 seconds. Free roaming. In many ways, it's about freedom, relief, and room to be more vulnerable. Once you create a phone-free learning environment, and once students know they're all in it together, they're kind of forced to take risks, which is an inherent part of learning, said Degani. It's difficult to take risks, step out on a limb, or do a presentation if you're worried about being filmed and posted on the internet at any point of time. Another example in the US is school proms. Nobody dances anymore. They're all afraid of being filmed and recorded. Degani added that some unexpected benefits for schools going phone-free have been things springing back to life, as he put it. Clubs are coming back, pupils playing sports at lunchtime instead of scrolling, reductions in fights and making eye contact in the hallways, he added. Gibb gave examples of schools that have seen increases in academic results and mental well-being, as well as a reduction in truancy and threats. He added the more lunches were being eaten too, with students feeling free to do so in public without being filmed or mocked. Added to this, Mills shared feedback from students who stated they felt like a massive pressure had been taken off them. They don't have to respond to chats or keep up with trends. They can concentrate and feel less overwhelmed. 90% of our students said they would not go back to having phones and no pouches because they enjoy school so much more. It's about building a cultural shift in school, giving students a sense of freedom, discovery and exploration, added Degani. I think these young people need that. They need that primary, unfiltered interaction and adventure. Anyway, I just thought it was a marvellous article, and I look forward to that coming of age in the fullness of time. With that, I'll pass you back to the headquarters of the dogs and wish you very well for the weekend. Cheer up.
Well, thank you so much for that, Jeff, and I think the time has come for us to have a bit of a break.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
We hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. And the teachers, the natives, are restless, and they should be. We've heard about how James Molino is trying to play down facts and figures with the Catholic teachers, but the public school teachers are the ones, of course, that we are the most concerned about, and they are certainly restless, and there is a question of a strike. And 3CR is always interested, of course, in people who are going to take action. So let's hear about it from Dale.
This is an article from The Age by Noel Towle and Jackson Graham. state school teachers threaten to strike as pay talks stall. Teachers in Victoria's 1,600 government schools say they will walk off the job for one day next month if the state Labor government fails to make a reasonable pay offer. The AEU said the strike, the first generalised shutdown of the state school system since 2013, would go ahead on March 24th if the government continued to disrespect its education workforce. A gathering of 100 union delegates at the AEU's Collingwood HQ on Friday voted to proceed with the action if the government does not formally respond to the union's log of claims lodged in June 2025. The talks on pay and condition for the state's 52,000 government school teachers have been underway since last year, with the union growing increasingly vocal about the lack of progress in the negotiations and mounting evidence of the underfunding of public schools. The union had sought a 35% pay increase over 3 years, with a 14% increase in the first year alone, arguing a big upfront pay increase was needed to put teachers' wages in the state on par with their peers around the country. The AEU previously linked Victoria's relatively poor pay for teachers to chronic staff shortages in state schools, leading to increasingly heavy workloads. The union's state branch president, Justin Mullaly, said a significant pay rise would attract more graduates and bring teachers who had left the profession back into the fold. Victorians graduate teachers are the worst paid in the country, earning $13,000 less than the country's best paid graduates in the Northern Territory and $8,700 less than those in New South Wales. The Victorian government had yet to make a counteroffer to the union's claims. A ballot of the school's workforce, which has been in a militant mood for several years, had begun, and majority support for protected industrial action would pave the way for the threatened shutdown. Mullaly, confident that the ballot process would produce a pro-strike majority, said the industrial action would go ahead if the government failed to come up with a reasonable pay offer by March 24th. We have been negotiating in good faith with the Allan Labor government to deliver the salaries and conditions that school staff need, Mullaly said. Their failure to come to the table with an offer is downright disrespectful. The union first raised the spectre of strike action in April last year in pursuit of its demand for pay rises for 52,000 Victorian government school teachers. A state government spokesperson said it was disappointed for parents who stood to lose a day's pay by staying home with their children if the action goes ahead. "We will continue to negotiate in good faith," they said. "We have always said teachers, education support staff, and principals deserve better pay and conditions." Education Minister Ben Carroll had previously said he too believed Victorian teachers deserved to be paid on par with their interstate counterparts. "I do believe our teachers are some of the most hardworking and talented in the nation, and I do believe they should have competitive wages with their interstate counterparts," the minister said back in April. Opposition education spokesman Brad Roswell criticised the government for risking school closures. "The Premier and Minister for Education must urgently resolve this dispute and ensure students' learning does not suffer further due to Labor's mismanagement." So that's the end of the article. Just a couple of points I'd like to throw in. The Victorian government spokesperson there said parents might lose work by staying home on strike day. We would think that public school parents and students will be out there supporting their teachers on that day and marching with them. The Allan government has tried at every turn to block this industrial action, but thankfully the Fair Work Commission has ruled in favour of teachers pursuing industrial action. Considering the Victorian Allan government is a Labor government, their attempts to block union action bespeaks how out of touch the modern Labor Party is with its roots. also a coalition spokesperson there, just paid some lip service politicking. It's disingenuous when they suggest their respect for public school teachers and public schools themselves might extend beyond that of the Labor Party, when these poor conditions are the result of over a decade of federal coalition policy that has stripped bare the funding of public schools in favour of the private sector. They've got form, so their comments are purely oppositional contradiction. And the AEU Victoria has told school members that the ballot for protected industrial action is now open, recommending a yes vote to all questions. So good luck to the teachers. We support you. Back to you, Jean.
Well, good luck to our teachers, and we hope that they get the message loud and clear through to the current Minister for Education, Ben Carroll, so that he understands that there are actually public schools there beside private schools in Victoria. But now we've got the best part of our program, our great state school, and Amy is going to tell us about that.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week. Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Romsey Primary School. Principals, welcome. Hello and welcome to Romsey Primary School. Thank you for taking the time to explore our website. Romsey Primary School vision is to be an inclusive and empowering learning community which fosters confident, creative, caring, curious and collaborative learners who dare to be excellent. The school values. Underpinning and informing our school vision are our school values of responsibility, make responsible choices, care for our school environment and the safety and well-being of others and yourself, respect, be cooperative, honest and tolerant of others, and integrity, be honest, sincere, truthful and trustworthy. The school vision. Our vision, values and supporting frameworks combine to form the Romsey Primary School Triangle. The base of the triangle is formed by five keys of success: organisation, getting along, resilience, persistence and confidence. These keys describe the qualities members of our school community need to develop and model in order to demonstrate our core values. When these values are honoured, our vision is achievable by all. Our environment. Upon entering the well-maintained grounds, you will notice the large outdoor learning areas that we have to cater for students' development, both academically, socially and emotionally. Our learning environment is a warm and caring space where we cater for the whole child. We encourage outdoor learning and investigation through our play pod, sand pit, and the climbing of trees. The way we learn and teach. We believe in finding the balance between explicit teaching and guiding inquiry to build the capacity of all learners through a gradual release of responsibility. The school continues to build teacher capacity in numeracy, literacy, and well-being through a school-based coaching approach. The school has a variety of support programs to develop student academic and social needs. Our intervention program assists children from years 1 to 6 who require support or extension. Numeracy is also a priority, with the school investigating and investing in programs to support the children in our care. Wellbeing. Our strong culture of care is extended through our wellbeing program and strong community partnerships. Romsey Primary School continues its support of a positive environment through the Positive School-Wide Behaviours and Komochi's Wellbeing Program. Our student leadership program includes opportunities to be school captains, sport leaders and curriculum leaders, specialist leaders or junior school council members. Our junior school council members regularly attend school council meetings to bring ideas and discuss upcoming events with the council. Extracurricular activities. Romsey Primary School has a student population of 326 students, and this year we are running 15 classrooms with specialist programs in Auslan, physical education, STEAM, and visual arts. Our students have cooking classes in our kitchen garden program where they grow their own vegetables and herbs in our kitchen garden. At Romsey Primary School, we promote a distributive leadership approach and encourage all members of the school community to have a voice. RPS and the community. We see our parents as our partners in their child's education and encourage families to become involved. We welcome the support of our incredible community. Our school council and parents and friends meet regularly and work hard to support the staff and students at Romsey Primary School. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The current enrolment, 323. And the ICSEA value is well below average at 986. Representative of a country community just north of the outskirts of Western Melbourne. The upper 25% of parental income make up 5% of students. The second level of parental income, 19% of students. There are 38% of students with parents in the third quartile of incomes, that's below 50%, and the lowest 25% of parental incomes make up 38% of students, with 4% from a language background other than English and 13% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government, $1.12 million, and the Victorian Government, $4.23 million. Private fees and contributions add another $84,000, and there's a further $138,000 from other private contributions. Per pupil, that works out at $17,246. In the capital, only $483,741 over 3 years. NAPLAN, just fine. This is a school doing an amazing job on very basic funding. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to our great state school, Romsey Primary School. But our time is gone. If you want to find out more about the dogs or you want to hear this program again, you can go to the 3CR website and listen to our podcasts, or you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. And it's up to me now to thank our producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and of course, Jeff. But from all of us here at 3CR and the dogs, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead, says Joe. But I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR. Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.